The Guardian. This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron's threat to block EU reforms branded economic insanity. Some surprising facts about hedgehogs. And in our audiobook review, we look at feminist audiobooks by Germaine Greer and Natasha Walter. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your weekly digest of news from the world of digital, tech and gaming. This week on the show,
PayPal is gigantic, but there are lots of other companies which are now trying to move into this space.
Hello, I'm Charles Arthur, and this week I meet John Collison of the startup Stripe.
And
we'll have our weekly tech news roundup with me, Jason Phipps, and I'll be getting the skinny on this year's Consumer Electronics Show when I speak to The Guardian's Rory Carroll in Las Vegas.
This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. And now, for the latest on all things digital, with Charles Arthur.
The problem of how to pay for things on the web has been one of the biggest challenges since Tim Berners-Lee came up with it. In fact, one of the ideas that they looked at when Berners-Lee was inventing the way the web would work was to have a method of paying directly from a web page. They discarded that idea, and so it's been left to others to come up with the best way to let you pay for things online. PayPal is gigantic, but there are lots of other companies which are now trying to move into this space. One of them is Stripe, and I have John Collison here, the co-founder of the company. Welcome, John. Tell us, what's the problem at the moment with online payments?
So the problem is most simply expressed as it's very hard to charge for anything you've created online. People who build things, sell things on the web today are left with two not very good choices. They can either sign up for a merchant account using this legacy system.
That's a credit card account.
Exactly, a credit card merchant account, and wait the weeks that takes to set up and pay fairly high monthly fees. Or they can send their buyers over to a payment network like PayPal or Google Checkout or Amazon Payments or any of these things. So with Stripe, what we're trying to do is to give website developers all the infrastructure they need to charge for things on their website.
So it sounds a bit like you're another version of PayPal or, you know, these other ones that you've mentioned, but a bit smaller, a bit newer. What's the difference that you make?
Yeah, the main difference is that we're not trying to control the payment, control the experience. We're giving people the code that they need to do this themselves. And so I can explain it in terms of what you'd see as a customer. Rather than being kicked over to PayPal or Google Checkout or one of these sites, paying there and then coming back to the website, you wouldn't notice anything amiss. You would be paying there directly on the website, and the website gets to use Stripe on the back end to handle the payment. And the reason we do this is when we were building Stripe, we thought, what's the experience that all the best websites want? And the best websites want to control the checkout, make sure they're guiding the customer through every step of the way, not kicking them over the fence to somewhere else. And so we built the thing that all the best, biggest websites do and all the infrastructure they want, but giving it to everyone.
So is this still credit card based, or are there alternatives that people can use? I mean, because there are so many currencies now on the web. There are sort of Facebook points, there are Xbox points, mm-hmm. there are credit cards, yeah. There are iTunes credits that you can have. So how do you, where do you think it's all going, and can you handle all those different ways that people might want to pay?
Right. So right now it's purely credit cards. It won't necessarily stay that way forever. We think of it in terms of, again, what do the best websites want? What's the way that you can let 90%, 95% of people pay you? That's credit cards in the US, but that won't necessarily always be credit cards. And in places outside of the US, that's not credit cards. And so the way we think of it is we're giving merchants a way for people to pay them. In the US, we think credit cards does a mighty good job of it, but that's not, that's not a hard and fast rule. We don't think of Stripe as a credit card company.
So, credit cards, we might think in the West that credit cards are the way that, lots of stuff gets done. But to some extent, that's only because the ways that people might otherwise want to pay, they can't do. There's no way of sort of inserting cash into your computer or perhaps taking credits that you've built up on, say, something like an Oyster card, you know, the travel card that we have here in the UK. There's no way of sort of transferring credits from those. Is there any movement you can see where those sorts of methods of exchanging value are actually being you know, used or pushed?
Yeah, it's very dangerous to bet against innovation and change, right? And there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem that new payment instruments have, where they start off on the fringes and they need something very compelling to help them displace this incumbent. And the thing that credit cards have going for them as a payment method online is they're so convenient and so ubiquitous. You know, I have a credit card in my wallet. I can read the number off it. I know that that number works online. I know that if there's a problem, I can call my bank and they'll help solve it. And, you know, with other payment methods, all these things, all these guarantees are still trickling into place. I think credit cards win on the, you know, sheer consumer penetration, consumer understanding, consumer confidence. That said, there's all kinds of interesting new stuff popping up, you know, from Bitcoin, this cryptocurrency, to M-Pesa, the mobile payment system in Kenya. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff happening.
Now, for yourselves, as a startup, I'm sort of guessing that it must have been that, given that you're basically standing between people's credit card accounts and the banks, that you have to set up, you have to first get the arrangement with the banks and the credit card companies set up so that you could then start offering. How easy is it as a small startup to persuade banks that you're trustworthy enough to let to be a conduit for people's money?
Yeah, it definitely takes work. And even though Stripe launched publicly in late 2011, we've actually been working on Stripe since late 2009. And a lot of that time we spent in between starting working on the company and launch was hiring the first few people, getting established with our first partners, and getting very comfortable in the infrastructure that we'd built, because a large part of what makes Stripe powerful is all the infrastructure that people need. We've built it from the ground up for the web. And so, you know, rather than say, to take a trivial example, rather than people getting their end of month statements in the mail like they do with a merchant account and opening them up and leafing through them, they can download them into Excel. They can get a real-time feed of those of that data and then, you know, bring that in and do analysis on it. And so a large part of what we did in the early days was establishing those banking relationships, building that very core technology so that now we can move very quickly.
A lot of payments are moving to mobile. I mean, you mentioned M-Pesa, which is colossal in Africa and actually growing in India as well. But in the US, there's Square. Over here in Europe, where PIN authorization for cards means Square hasn't really got gained any ground yet. There's companies like iZettle and a number of others. Are you able to cope with mobile payments, and how rapidly do you think that's going to grow?
Yeah, we're seeing a really exciting trend. So first off, because, again, Stripe is building infrastructure rather than user-facing products, what we get to see is the people using Stripe doing all these innovative things that we would never have even thought of. And so we see people doing stuff on the web, doing stuff on mobile, doing stuff on through all these different media, and even doing things that blur the line between them. And so one startup using Stripe Exec, based in San Francisco, there you can create an account. They're a cloud labor service. You can create an account on Exec on the desktop and then download the mobile app and have someone do something for you and get billed for it. And so is that a mobile payment? Is that a desktop payment? It really blurs the lines between around what kind of payment this even is.
And John, if people are interested in finding out more about Stripe, where should they go?
It's very easy. Log on to stripe.com. You can create an account in a few minutes and be accepting payments then.
John Collison, thank you very much.
Cheers.
For breaking tech news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology and follow us on Twitter at GuardianTW. And now for our Tech Weekly News Roundup with Jason Phipps.
Thanks, Alex. And here are some of the top news stories this week on guardian.co.uk/technology.
And this year, Paul?
Welcome, my friend, Steve Ballmer, Microsoft CEO. Glad to have you here.
This week, the 2013 Consumer Electronics Show took place in Las Vegas. CES is traditionally where many of the big brands launch their new TVs, phones, cameras, gadgets and software. This year, Microsoft have scaled down their presence, although their CEO, Steve Ballmer, could not contain himself and made a surprise appearance as part of a keynote address on smartphones. The show's highlights included PaperTab, a new tablet that is as thin and flexible as paper, Happy Labs, new smart fork that can measure your food intake and help you eat at the right rate, and Samsung's smart fridge with LCD display and Evernote app integration. Coming up, we'll have a full rundown on CES when I speak to The Guardian's Rory Carroll from Las Vegas. Electric car sales in the UK rapidly picked up speed in 2012, with numbers almost doubling in the first 9 months, ahead of a new generation of models by BMW, Ford and Tesla Motors arriving this year. Growth in the electric car market hugely outstripped growth in the wider car industry, which saw a sales increase of just 5.4% in 2012 against 2011. The turnaround for the low-carbon car's fortunes follows a £5,000 government grant here in the UK launched in January 2011. The cars, which are seen as crucial to meet the government's climate targets and tackle air pollution, do, however, remain a fraction of the 1.9 million conventional cars sold last year. This week, Google's executive chair, Eric Schmidt, completed a four-day fact-finding trip to North Korea. In stark comparison to South Korea, its neighbour, it has little or no open access to the internet and is decades behind in its digital economy. Schmidt said that North Korea's decision to stay isolated would affect both their physical world and their economic growth. He is the highest-ranking US business executive to visit North Korea and has been criticised for what people see as an attempt to extend Google's reach within the impoverished and repressive state. Schmidt, however, said that his mission was private and humanitarian. He stated that his visit was to talk with the North Koreans about a free and open internet. And finally, Microsoft's low profile at CES was not the only story about the tech giant this week. News broke that their offices in Palo Alto were burgled, and rather embarrassingly for Microsoft, the only hardware stolen was their collection of iPads.
Remember, for breaking tech news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology and follow us on Twitter at GuardianTW.
The Consumer Electronics Show, hashtag CES to you and me, is one of the biggest tech trade shows in the world and the highlight of the year in terms of hardware and software releases in the US. It all happens at the Las Vegas Convention Center, and I am joined now by The Guardian's Rory Carroll, who has been covering this tech extravaganza for us. He joins me down the line. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Rory.
Thank you very much for having me, Jason. Happy to be here.
So it's day two as we speak. Have there been any wow factors? Have you seen anything that's really blown your mind?
Yeah, there have, actually. Last night I flew a helicopter using thoughts alone. My sheer mind power was enough to fly a helicopter. Admittedly, this was a toy helicopter, but it was actually my brainwaves that were sending it up into soaring over a ballroom in a Las Vegas hotel. This is a technology developed by a company called NeuroSky, and they attach basically a sensor around your head, and then just by concentration, you can actually lift the helicopter into the air, and a computer that you're basically attached to that monitors and shows the degree of your concentration. And that was terrific, actually. And in terms of applications, it's still kind of in the early stages, but I think mainly it's a toy for now. But they say that in the future, this could well have applications for mental health or for the military. So that was good fun.
And so what kind of technologies is it using? I take it it's using some kind of heart rate, maybe, and what's strapped around your head? Is it using some sort of...
Yeah, something called ECG and EEK. I won't dare try to pronounce what they actually stand for, which it monitors partly the brain waves. If you concentrate, in your brain patterns can be registered, whereas opposed to if you relaxed, for instance, then your brain waves will be sending a different signal. And this machine, which is very lightweight, this is a little strap around your head, a little clip that clips onto your ear, and a little kind of node that rests against your forehead. And this can detect these brain waves. And in addition to that, some of your heartbeats as well. sort of things are enough for it to control the machine. It's terrific, really.
On the Guardian website, we've been reporting that it seems to boil down to a kind of battle of the TVs this year, with big launches by LG, Samsung. Is that the case?
Yes, very much so. It just seems, just when you think TVs can't get any bigger or flatter or sleeker, then they do. And all the big companies here, between Panasonic, LG, Sony, Samsung, etc., have been unveiling their new TVs, because they're desperate to try to kind of to grow the market, because it's been sort of flat for the last couple of years, and they're all trying to find a way to kind of to get a leapfrog the competition. And now 3D, which was the big buzz at CES last year, is largely dead, because it just the sales of the past last year were quite disappointing. So the manufacturers have adjusted to that, and so they've kind of more or less ditched 3D for now, and instead they're trying to go for sharper images.
That's very interesting. It was sold in many ways as the sort of the, if not the future, the medium term of TVs, 3D. So it's quite interesting that there's been a sort of a turnaround on that.
Yes, because given all the buzz and hype last year, I mean, it seemed to be almost inevitable, if you believe them, the manufacturers, that the consumers are going to, you know, to swarm over these products, and they didn't, for various reasons. I think one being that people just find it's kind of uncomfortable to be watching 3D TV for a long period of time. Another problem may have been just the fact that there's a lack of programming with not having enough 3D, unless you're buying 3D or Blu-ray movies. You just couldn't profit from it. So for that reason, they've moved on, at least for now. And for example, LG, they are now pinning their hopes on a technology called OLED, which is organic light emitting diode technology. And that's basically what that, how it works. Frankly, I don't know, but I do know it looks terrific. I'm normally not especially sensitive to, you know, the resolution and if images are looking sharper or not. But actually, in this case, I did notice it. The colors were just so much more vibrant and so on. And these sales, the 55-inch OLED high-definition TV will go on sale here in the U.S. in March. Yours for a song, just $12,000. So with, you know, Guardian salaries, obviously, we can be snapping them up big time. Meantime, the other firms like Samsung are all pinning their hopes on ultra definition or ultra high definition TV. So having tried to convince us for the past, you know, 5-10 years that you needed HD TV, and that was the be all and end all, now they're saying, nah, HD TV is, it's yesterday's news. Now what you really need is ultra, you know, HD, which is 4 times sharper than HD. At which the point, you know, people are saying, well, hang on, 4 times sharper than HD is more real than real. I mean, if you're looking at a person on television, they will look more real than a person standing beside you, which is quite bizarre, actually. And so, I mean, you just wonder at what point do they, you know, can they go too far on this? So, but obviously the manufacturer's thinking there's a lot more mileage in this, and that people will still want ever sharper resolution and ever bigger television.
Well, I've got two sort of pet theories on the high definition of television. One, I think that 3D, for instance, in cinema is so good that very few screens, TV screens, can sort of emulate that experience. And then also, I think we've been left with the legacy of the last 10 years of plasma, which has been, was actually a diminution of quality from the cathode ray tube. And it's a little bit like DAB radio. I think we took a step down in quality to move forward in technology. And now technology is trying to sort of reestablish that sort of like a hi-fi, high definition quality experience for customers. But anyway, I think Charles might challenge me on that. I noticed that there was lots of reports around the fact that some of the press, some of the more snooty press, were saying that CES at these kinds of fairs are really missing the point, and that hardware is not where it's at, that software is where it's at. I take it there was a huge presence for the sort of software end of things at the show.
Yes, I mean, this is an accusation that's been leveled at CES for the past 3 years, that basically it's a dwindling relevance, that all of its focus and obsession about robots and hardware really is the behind the times, because, you know, the world is ever more obsessed with apps and software and the services that the machine can give you, not the casing in which the service comes. And so they've been quite I mean, on one level, you don't actually notice any change here in CS because people, it's almost bigger than ever, I think. I mean, they're saying maybe 150,000 people, maybe as many as or perhaps a little bit more than last year, which is the biggest ever. In terms of space, it's just cavernous. I mean, you're talking about 1.5 million square feet of exhibition space. So the energy and the enthusiasm of the people here is certainly unquestioned. But I think, you know, you can see some ripples of disappointment here, or a sense of like, well, you know, that maybe there's something more interesting happening elsewhere. And this is partly because of the absence of the big companies and the likes of Facebook and Google. And the fact that they're not here is always a bit of a gap, really, in things. I think a lot of people are feeling that there's a fewer surprises this year in terms of the technology, that there just haven't been as many much of the wow factors before. And some people, I spoke to one guy yesterday, a veteran of CES, and he said normally it would take him, you know, 2-3 days to kind of go around and see, you know, to digest everything that's on offer. And he claimed yesterday, he told me, look, I did it 4 hours today. He said he just went around and he just didn't see anything that especially turned him on, or he felt that a lot of the technology was kind of samey. So, it's in terms of, you know, is CES losing its mojo? It depends who you talk to, you know. I mean, a lot of people I spoke to said that they think it's bigger and better than ever, and yet I think some of the more kind of thoughtful kind of veterans and the more honest ones are sensing that CES has lost something, and that it will need to try to reboot and reinvent itself next year.
So CES is billed as the place to see tomorrow's technology. Was there anything that you saw you thought it's not only tomorrow's, it won't even make it to the end of the day?
Yeah, well, there was the incongruous sight of a smart fork, which is made by a French company called Happy Labs. And this is a fork, it's only a prototype yet, but they're about to start making, they hope, millions of them, which tells you, the fork knows how much and how fast you're eating. And once you're overdoing it, it will vibrate, and a little orange light will flash, and it will say, hey, fatty, you know, slow down or eat less. The Happy Labs folks are saying this is going to be a big thing in terms of diet. This would be a great way for people who are trying to control their eating to do so, because you have this reminder that's, you know, in your hand. And this has caused a bit of a minor sensation here. And when I spoke to them yesterday, they said that in the past 48 hours, 62 journalists from 62 countries have been, you know, beseeching them to get more details. In fact, that the BBC have been interviewed them 5 times to the point that they had to chase them away and say, guys, go away, you know. So, I mean, it's obviously this hits a nerve here, and they certainly feel like kind of surfing the zeitgeist. And yet, that said, I have to wonder, I mean, really, a vibrating fork, I mean, is that... are people really going to buy that?
It says a lot about the state of technology that we didn't bat an eyelid when we were discussing a mind-controlled helicopter, but we start to get sort of pernickety when we start talking about a new techno fork.
I wish you well, and I guess we'll see whether it does conquer the world.
Great. Well, we wish you well as well, Rory. I hope you survive the rest of the CES, and we hope to hear you again on Tech Weekly at another time.
Great. Okay, thanks a lot, Jason.
A huge thanks to Rory Carroll, and to read all of his musings on CES and much, much more, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. The music featured in this week's show is by Jeremy Razimbaud, a.k.a. Morbach Magenta. To listen to the track in full, just go to his SoundCloud page. That's SoundCloud/Morbach Magenta, all one word. Or you can follow the link on our blog.
That's it for this edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It was produced by Jason Phipps and The Guardian Multimedia team. And we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.